I'm Nina Totenberg, and this is The Connection. For the gardener, summer can mean chaos, a mad dance of planting, weeding, watering, and picking under a relentless hot sun and a too often dry sky. Autumn, on the other hand, is sweet relief with cool nights, clear days, yellow, gold, red hues, and welcomed rain. It's true that fall is the season of closing up and watching the world go dormant, but it also brings rebirth. Butterflies hover on wild asters, pumpkins burst with ripe color, crabapple trees weigh heavy with fruit, and the geese fly and honk overhead. In the garden, it's time to rake, clear, gather seeds, drop bulbs, divide plants, and tidy all around. It's also a season to discover the garden's subtleties before winter sets in. Connection listeners, do you find meaning and melancholy in the fall garden? What makes it so special? 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us on the web at theconnection.org. And joining me today is Alan Lacey, Professor of Philosophy Emeritus at Richard Stockton College of New Jersey, author of The Garden in Autumn and former garden columnist for both The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and Ketzel Levine, NPR's Doyen of Dirt and author of the new book Plant This, Best Bets for Year-Round Gorgeous Gardens. Welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Ketzel, let me start with you. To expand on a couple of things that we just mentioned, what is it that makes the fall such a beloved season for gardeners and for gardens?
Well, I'll tell you, Nina, you touched on a great deal of it. There is a sense of relief, I think, ultimately. That's probably the best word. That running outside all day in July and August, seeing, you know, what's dying, what's schwitzing, what I'm going to lose, what isn't going to make it through the summer. You know, it's over. All of that stress is coming to a close. And because I happen to love the fall garden and plan ahead for it, I start to see all of the things that I planted last year or in the spring that start to come into their own now, start to really hit their stride. So when so much of the garden is looking burned and tired and give me a break, let me out of here, I'm seeing fall plants come on with just gusto. And it's like out of my control. Things I did earlier are all coming to fruition now.
You also have said that this is a good time to edit your garden. What does that mean?
Well, I think at this point, first of all, there's a lot of stuff for many of us that probably either didn't make it through this long, hot summer or that has just been too darn much work to keep alive. So I think the first round of editing is to say to yourself, forget it, I'm not doing this plant anymore, you know, to get rid of the stuff that hasn't performed for you. But I think the next thing is to look at, you know, where the holes are. Is fall coming into your garden? And if there is no fall coming into your garden, if you're not seeing tall spires of salvia, and if you're not seeing any asters, or if you're not noticing that shrubs are burying or getting ready to change color, then it's definitely time to reassess and start planning for fall in the garden.
You know, we all think of a fall garden as being sort of the russet colors.
Mm.
But in studying up for this, and because I have to admit, I'm really not a gardener. I have a black thumb. I love gardeners.
I wouldn't have said anything.
But I never believe in lying to listeners. My mother was a great gardener. My father appreciates flowers and has taught me to appreciate flowers. But they die at my hand.
So you thought fall was what?
Well, I thought fall was the russet colors, but I gather that it's often purple and blue also.
Yeah, well, blue is fall for me, but that's because I'm a salvia freak. And there are a lot of salvias, and we're talking perennial salvias. I won't get into too much botanic Latin with you because I don't want to alienate you, Nina. But there are plants called Salvia guaranitica, which is one species, and another with an ugly-sounding name, which is a gorgeous plant called Salvia oleaginosa. And these are plants that throw up tall blue, whether baby blue or midnight blue flowers, that can be on plants that are 5, 6, 7 feet tall. So imagine these things like, you know, like licks of the tips of flames, you know, all throughout the garden. I really, and the salvias really bring home blue for me in the fall. There's one thing that you said, though, that I did want to mention. You said that this was the time for tidying up, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to tell you, this is not the time for tidying up.
That's just what a non-gardener thought.
No. As a matter of fact, I think there are a lot of gardeners, and particularly novice gardeners, who, you know, sort of think like, okay, you know, it's time to cut back the perennials because the flowers don't look so good, and it's time to rake, and it's time to do this. The fact is that this is a tough time of year for a gardener who is compulsive, because the fall garden is at its best in chaos. To let flowers go to seed, to let leaves die, you know, to start experiencing the different textures and, as I say, the chaos and the jumble that happens when you just back off and let things decay in their own time.
Alan Lacey, gardener extraordinaire, are you a neatnik or a chaotic nick?
I am not a neatnik, and I like the tumbly look at the end of the season. I like the way that plants lean into one another. I like the tapestry effect of, and we, Kathleen and I, can talk about salvias. We could turn this into a whole hour about salvias, and we're not
don't
talking
do that.
About the.
Don't
we're
do
not
that.
Talking about. Let me say, we're not talking about the fire engine salvias that grow 8 inches tall that you see with marigolds at every gas station in the country. We're talking about noble creatures, most of them of North American origin, which really come to their best in the autumn. But yeah, I like to let things go in a very untidy way. The person I live with has some corrective tendencies, and we've managed to work out a fairly decent modus vivendi. A little bit of cutting back and a little bit of sprawling, and you know, finally a hard frost comes, and it's more or less over.
Let me ask the two of you. Each of you is at a different coast, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
What is the definition of fall? When does it begin? And I would assume that fall in California is really different from fall in New Jersey or even fall in the Northwest where you are, Ketzel. Go ahead. You do take this first.
Can I come in on this?
Yeah. Well, let Ketzel go first and then
she's first. Okay. I'm sorry.
Go ahead, Ketzel.
Well, I have a longer wait for fall. You know, we can still pretend that we're in summer pretty much through September because a lot of the summer perennials are still blooming and a lot of the fall color does not really start to happen. But for me, you know, it's all about the light. So even though the garden itself may not really be throwing itself into fall abandon, you know, once the light starts to change and the slants of the lights starts to hit in a different way. Yeah, I know we're on our way, but as I say, I think that our gardens here hold on to a lot of the summer color and a lot of the summer abundance for a bit longer.
Okay, Alan, what's the definition for you?
Well, if you look in a book, you find that there's the astronomical definition of autumn, which in the Northern Hemisphere is that it begins with the autumn equinox and it ends with the winter solstice, September 22nd, December 21st. In the meteorological world, Americans say that it begins the 1st of September and ends the 1st of November. The Brits will say that it begins the 1st of August and ends the 1st of November. I say it begins when it begins, in your garden. There are certain signs. For me, one is the blooming of sweet autumn clematis in the marshlands and woodlands of southern New Jersey. It's also the time when crabgrass turns a very pretty color, sort of pinkish purple, and it's dropping its seeds, millions of seeds everywhere, and the little chickweeds are beginning to sprout. So you see the death of the awful summer weeds, and you see the birth of the great winter weeds. So we have weeds with us all year round.
This is the season for chickweed, then, huh? This is when people who have been bemoaning all of the crabgrass in their lawn should start celebrating its inherent beauty, right, Alan?
That's right. And then watch the chickweed, because that's very pretty. I've even known nurseries that have sold chickweed.
It's also sort of the time of harvest, isn't it?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's also a time of fruition. Many of the plants that look wonderful in the fall look quite wonderful in another way in the spring. Take the flowering crabapples. They bloom very briefly in the spring. You know, the first warm weekend takes them out. And all of a sudden, in the middle of August, some of them are just loaded down with tiny apples of all colors. And it's a beautiful sight. We see the fruition of spring. We also see in autumn, I think, the beginnings of spring, because it's the time when we plant our bulbs, always adding new daffodils every year.
Doesn't autumn make you a little sad, though? Because it means winter's coming.
I don't get sad about winter until winter is here. I like the last warm day, and I kind of deny that it's here, and then there's nothing I can do about it anyway. And I do have friends who insist that that winter is the best season of the year. And there are actually a great number of plants that bloom through the winter, many winter crocuses, hellebores. It's not a dead season. My feelings about not liking winter are mainly not about the plants that grow, but that's just the fact that I don't like cold.
How about you, Ketzel? Does it make you sad?
Does fall make me sad?
Yeah.
I think that I'll never get over being so grateful that I don't have to go to school again. That I don't think September will ever be anything but an enormous relief for me. And I do feel newly energized by the fall. Do I have a second?
Yeah, you have about a minute.
I just stopped teaching.
Yes?
I have that feeling, too. I said I just retired from the classroom, and I've got a feeling like, you know, in the third or fourth grade, you know, that I don't have to go back to that, except I'm not going back to 19-year-olds.
You've got about a minute, Ketzel.
I had something that I had wanted to read to you by a wonderful garden writer, now deceased Henry Mitchell, who you might have known from the Washington Post. He has a couple of sentences on fall. Do I have a second to read that to you?
Yeah.
Okay. There is, and I mention this because if there's anything I love as much about plants, it's dogs. So I read this. This speaks to me. There is no need to think of September as the trash bin of the year with just scraps of leftover things in the garden, because many things are only coming to perfection at the end of summer, a soft and gleaming season that reminds me of a long-eared hound with his yearly bath, sweet like a hayfield. That's fall.
Well, I must say that you two are more sanguine than I am. Maybe I should get my hands dirty or something like that.
Why does fall depress you?
Because I know that it's going to be cold and bleak soon, and that we're not going to have much to look at, and that the leaves will fall, and the flowers won't be there anymore. And that, I think, is kind of sad.
We need to turn you on to some plants that will get you through the whole year, Nina. This is what I'm hearing.
Okay. Ketzel Levine, Doyenne of Dirt, Alan Lacey, gardener extraordinaire and author. We'll be back in a minute. The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on NPR.
From Boston University.
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. Autumn officially begins next month, but for the gardener, fall is already here. And we're talking about the garden in autumn today and its distinctive charm and charms. Join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Alan Lacey, author of The Garden in Autumn and former garden columnist for both The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and Ketzel Levine, NPR's Doyenne of Dirt and author of Plant This, Best Bets for Year-Round Gorgeous Gardens. Now, Ketzel, when I first knew you, you were a reporter of news events at NPR. When did you first fall in love with gardening?
Well, I fell in love with gardening as a way to recover from deadlines as a reporter at NPR. I was, you might recall, reporting primarily for Morning Edition, and I used to make a 5 a.m. deadline, and then I would hightail it over to either Brookside Gardens, which is in suburban Maryland, or Dumbarton Oaks later in the day, and I would watch people out in the garden. It was April, you know, singing and whistling and pruning and planting, and I thought, I think I'm on the wrong end of this. And that was what really sort of made me think, reevaluate what I was doing with my life and my career. And for a little while, anyway, I did leave NPR and go into horticulture.
And Alan, what about you? When did you first fall in love with gardening?
Oh, dear. It was in third grade. And I was in severe trouble because I was being disciplined by a teacher, and she put me under her desk, and it was a hot April day, and I said I wanted to go to the bathroom, and she kicked me three or four times, and so I reached up and bit her. I drew blood.
Ooh.
And I was expelled. She was like the Wicked Witch of whatever direction it is. And a very kindly woman named Mrs. Harkey took me under her wing and said, if you will work in my nursery over the weekends, I will see to it that you finish your third grade work by tutoring. And she owned an iris nursery, and she hybridized them. And she showed me how to do it, how to take the pollen and put it take the anther and the pistil and get them together and create sex and then, you know, hope that something beautiful would result from it. And I was hooked. And that was, you know, that was it. And at times the love was dormant, but I worked in a seed store as my first job in the eighth grade. The woman who ran it made me memorize the catalog, including all the Latin names. And it just has stayed with me ever since. And it's a passion.
Alan, there's sort of a community about gardening, isn't there?
Oh, yes. Everybody knows everybody else. You know, I've talked to Ketzel on the telephone. Ketzel and I have friends in common. We all know who is retiring.
I don't think we've ever had eyes on each other, Alan. I don't think we've ever actually met.
No, but we talked from a motel room in Greensboro. There was a radio hookup with Christopher Lloyd. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I think it was a decade.
And I was in a horrible motel with black velvet sheets. I mean, it was not one of your. It was not a horticultural experience exactly. But we're all connected. We all know nurserymen. I know nurserymen out on the West Coast. There are meetings. The Brits and the English. The English and Americans got together for symposia. We talk. You know, we know Rosemary Veery, who recently died and was a friend of mine. It's a highly interconnected world. And even if you don't know, you know, everybody yet, the next meeting or the next walking around the corner or the next going to a nursery and seeing somebody, you're going to run into somebody. And so I'm sure at Ketzel that one of these days you'll be there. We'll be on a platform together, or we'll be buying, what was it in Portland? They sell pokeweed in Portland.
I have no idea what pokeweed is.
Well, what he's intimating is that we sell what we sell as an ornamental what folks on the East Coast consider a horrific weed.
It is a horrific weed, yes. Yeah, but it's, you know, the nursery I'm talking about, I think, probably.
Is it, but Ketzel, is it a horrific weed?
It certainly can be. You know, that's a whole different subject that happens in gardening in America. It is an astonishing thing how, depending on where you live and what the climate is and what the soil is, that a plant that may barely, you know, get by here or at least behave well is completely noxious in another state and something that everyone has an enormous responsibility to stay on top of so that they don't end up buying something when they see it in Oregon, bring it back to New Jersey, and find that it's eaten half of the state.
I think one example might be the sweet autumn clematis, which is a monster in southern New Jersey. It's evidently a major weed, very, you know, very beautiful, but I don't like what it's doing. And how is it in the Pacific Northwest?
I don't see all that much of it, but I don't think that people were as enamored with it as an ornamental, so it wasn't planted as widely to begin with. But we've got plenty of other foes out here.
We're going go to Alan, we're going to go to some calls. 1-800-423-8255.
Sure.
Helen is calling from Wellfleet on Cape Cod. Go ahead, Helen.
There are two things that I find interesting by way of admission. One is the fact that most of the show isn't concentrated on the harvest, which was briefly mentioned before. And I think it reflects how far we've come from our own food production. The other is that everybody I know in the fall, including the most hard-bitten, overworked landscapers, feel that there's a whole sense of there's a sense of hope that you get from doing the major activity, which is putting in bulbs. And that hasn't been mentioned either. My sense of excitement and the chores invited by putting in, you know, the sense of chores that I have by putting in bulbs as a way of, like, kind of banking things for the future.
I think it's an accident that we haven't mentioned the harvest or the bulbs. I thought I'd said something about that briefly, but I keep thinking of after Catherine S. White, who was the garden writer for the New Yorker, died, and her wonderful articles were published as Onward and Upward in the Garden. Her husband E.B. White wrote a preface in which he said that he remembered her on her knees in November, planting daffodils and tulip bulbs. And what he said was that Catherine was planting the resurrection. And there's this anticipatory aspect, and you're quite right. The chores of putting the garden to bed and of planning for the next season are an extremely important part of the season.
Lots of people put bulbs in the very early spring, though. They don't do it in November always, do they?
It depends what they're planting for, Nina. If they're putting them in the spring, chances are they're putting in summer and fall bulbs. But if they're wanting their spring bulbs, they'll be putting them in between now and November.
Ketzel, let me ask you something about the personality of the gardener. You talk about gardening as a salvation. For you personally, you did a wonderful series about sort of famous people who are famous for other things, like actors, whose real life is as a gardener. Do you think that there is something really therapeutic about the garden, inspirational, something like that?
Yeah, I think, you know, scratch a gardener, even cynical ones like myself, and you'll certainly get there pretty quickly. Because what we're talking about is, I mean, ultimately, with all due respect to how complicated planning a garden is and preparing a garden, when you get down to the actual physical work, you know, you're talking about this brilliant, mindless release where it's just you, tool, soil. And the work itself is about as calming and connecting as anything that I have ever done. You know, I don't have the wherewithal to really meditate. At least at this point, I'm still a little bit too hyper in my life to sit completely still and feel everything slip away from me through concentration. But by not even concentrating and by losing myself in the act of gardening, you know, I'm there, and that is, of course, incredibly, incredibly healing.
Alan?
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's digging in the dirt is like saying a mantra. I have to back off a little bit from this, because in the legends of my family, my son said, you know, they observed at one point, you know, Hella does the gardening, and you garden at the computer. And there's a certain sense in which this is true. I'm trying to be better, though, and it's been, you know, I've been doing some cleanup. But she's got a better eye, and, you know, also I have a greater tolerance for disorder than she does. Or she has less appreciation of disorder. I don't know how to put it.
Go ahead.
But certainly the work is part of it. There's some things I enjoy more than others.
The number, 1-800-423-8255. We have Gabe on the line. Go ahead, Gabe.
Hi. I just wanted to say about, you know, fall, the kind of looming of winter and that kind of thing. You guys have been talking about it as such an awful kind of dread. And I think of...
No, they haven't, just I have.
Just you. I'm sorry. And I'm not a gardener at all. I've watched my dad working hard all summer at it, but... I've never been into it at all, but I think of T.S. Eliot in the beginning of the Wasteland, where he talks about April being the cruelest month, in fact, where it's the spring, you know, and that the fall is, he says, you know, winter kept us warm, covering earth in forgetful snow. And I just think about when I was younger, and, you know, fall to me was the idea of putting on warm jammies and getting ready for bed and curling up with a comic book or something. And not kind of this dreading feeling of death and that kind of thing. But, I mean, a lot of people, in those comic books, there was a great Calvin and Hobbes where Calvin was trying to appreciate fall, and he said, I just can't because it's kind of like the meal before an execution. You know, school is coming and all that kind of beginning in a new way, which, again, I think is just beginning. It's regeneration.
Mm-hmm. Alan, you know, Gabe has taken us from T.S. Eliot to the comics, but you have written a lot about literature and gardens.
Right.
And one of the interesting things that you have said is that, you know, we think we there are all these Brits who write about gardens in the fall, but the British really don't have much of a garden in the fall, do they?
No, they don't, and it's just because of their high latitude and the fact that after fall begins, the days just decline precipitously. It's not like September song, you know, where they decline, you know, to a precious few. It's a rapid descent into darkness. And the poets, whether it's Pope or Tennyson or Thomas Hood or Coleridge, write in a very gloomy way about fall. There's one. Can I read a couple of lines here?
Just sure.
Thomas Hood has a poem called No, and it goes, no warmth, no cheerfulness, no unhealthful ease, no uncomfortable feel in any member, no shade, no shine, no butterflies, no bees, no fruits, no flowers, no leaves, no trees, November. And then Shelley wrote a poem called A Dirge, and I don't even need to read that. And Tennyson writes one called Song, and it's about the season, and it starts off, the air is damp and hushed and close as a sick man's room when he taketh repose an hour before death. My very heart faints and the whole soul grieves in the moist, rich smell of the rotting leaves and the breath of the fading ages of box beneath and the year's last rose. Well, you know, you turn to American poetry and it's very, very sunny. Henry Wadsworth Longfellow and Evangeline hailed autumn as that beautiful season, the summer of all saints. And I could, you know, continue to these quotes, but it's just, in general, if you look at British and American poetry of this season, you find that the Brits don't think much of it, and the Americans are quite sunny about it, and New Englanders in particular.
The number, 1-800-423-8255, that's 1-800-423-TALK, and Peg is on the line. Go ahead, Peg.
Hi, Nina. I grew up in a family. We did a lot of gardening, and every fall we'd go out gathering hickory nuts or just everything from the countryside. And I had a very, I think, spiritual connection to nature, which now in my adult life I'm now what you'd call a witch. And my coven has a whole series of rituals and rites that we do throughout the year, which mimic the Western European agricultural calendar. So we have festivals like Lammas, which is a harvest festival in early August, and then the autumnal equinox, and then Samhain, which means summer's end, which most people see as Halloween, our harvest home. But my comment was that the house where we hold our rituals, one of the owners of the house has planted a garden that he designed over the course of about 25 years, and he specifically included plants that we could use to decorate our temple and use in our rites. Certain colors of blooms that are written into the poetry of the rituals, certain plants like holly or, you know, when we knew the acorns would be ready, certain kinds of blooms. And that was just kind of my comment that we tried, even though this is from Western Europe where the seasons are slightly different, although I did spend a January in England where they'd had a very wet winter and there were forsythia and roses in bloom in January. It's very odd.
Well, thank you, Peg, very much.
Sure.
This just proves we have an extremely wide diversity of listeners. Dave is calling from Buffalo, New York. Go ahead, Dave.
Hi. This is my first year of planting a garden ever. The problem is I live on the second floor, and so it was a rooftop garden, and after I got all the books and got all the pots and the dirt, I didn't get anything in until, like, July. I would like to get started earlier next year. What would I plant for the winter? on a rooftop garden.
Okay, each of you gets a crack at this. Go ahead, Alan.
Where are you?
Where are you?
You're
in Buffalo, so you're really, you have a really long winter. We only have about a minute and a half in this segment, so
okay. So
go ahead, Alan, quickly, and then I'll turn to the
guests. I would say in Buffalo, forget it. And plant some things in the spring. Get some pots and plant them in the spring because, you know, I lived in upstate New York. I wouldn't plant anything at that time of year, and particularly outdoors, or get a greenhouse.
That's, I'll put it on the roof.
I'm sorry to be so discouraging, but,
no,
yeah, but I have lived up there.
Ketzel, any thoughts?
Well, bulbs. Get your bulbs in. So, you know, start there. I mean, you can. I think there are some deciduous shrubs that you might be able to grow. Might even be some conifers, although depending on your wind exposure.
Very heavy wind exposure.
You have very heavy wind exposure?
Yeah, I found
out. Yeah, you better stick to six-inch bulbs. At least for now. You know, you can do something else in the spring, but I would load up with all sorts of bulbs and you'll be okay.
How about some little evergreens?
Well, depending on his wind, they could create a kind of desiccation where those poor things will lose all their moistures and die. So unless they're protected, you know, evergreens can be terrific. Evergreens can be a curse on a balcony.
Hmm.
It's going to be, as you'll discover, Nina, as we turn you into more and more of a gardener, it is trial and error, and one has to lose plants in order to find out what works. But For a real kick in the pants and start off the season nicely, get your bulbs in now and start with some of the little iris and crocus, daffodils, tulips. Just load them in there.
And fall crocus? Can you have fall crocus?
He can have that. Absolutely, he'd put that in later. But fall crocus is a very beautiful thing.
And then they would come up in the fall, Dave. Thanks for calling. We're talking about the garden in autumn today and its bittersweet beauty. Call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. I'm Nina Totenberg, and this is The Connection.
From Boston University.
I'm Nina Totenberg. This is The Connection. And we're digging into the fall garden today to muse on its splendor, its harvest, its melancholy. Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me today is Ketzel Levine, NPR's doyen of dirt and the author of the new book, Plant This, Best Bets for the Year-Round Gorgeous Gardens. And Alan Lacey, author of The Garden in Autumn and former garden columnist for The Wall Street Journal and The New York Times, and I should say author of other garden books. Could you both talk to me a little bit about why stuff changes color in the fall? I never am quite sure why it is we have a great leaf year or a not-so-great leaf year. Which of you pretends to be the best expert on this to start off with?
You want to toss a coin, Alan?
Well, I looked it up this morning to make sure that I was absolutely correct. But it's not, you know, I went to an encyclopedia and read. It's not Jack Frost and with his buckets of paint. And certainly the color doesn't really begin only after the first frost. It starts a long time before that. In general, leaf color is – some of the colors are there all along. We just don't see them because of the chlorophyll. The main function of plants during the main growing season is to produce energy by turning sunlight into energy. And they do this through process of photosynthesis using chlorophyll, which is green. There are some other pigments, however, that are present in leaves at all times during the growing season. They're the carotenoids, which are the yellow and gold and orange pigments. And when photosynthesis stops, which happens as a result of lowering temperatures and either lengthening nights or decreasing days, I'm not quite sure which, and they're the same thing. The photosynthesis goes away, stops, the chlorophyll goes away, and lo, you know, here are these other colors that have just been masked by the green of the chlorophyll. It's a little bit different from with reds and purples, because these pigments are anthocyanins, and they are formed as a result of chemical changes in sugars in the leaves that start taking place in August. So you've got all this complicated chemistry going on, and when the chlorophyll vanishing is like a curtain going up in a theater that reveals what's really on the stage, and you see the drama there.
But is there what makes a great leaf year? You know, in just a few words, is it enough rain? Is it a quick frost? Is it a dry season? What?
The answer is yes.
All of those things?
I mean, it's a combination of those things. You know, a nice hot, dry summer followed by the appropriate rains at the right time, you know, and slowly lowering temperatures, all those things contribute.
Slowly lowering temperatures.
Right, and we know also that there are, you know, that there's some area, as a whole, the United States is much better than almost anywhere else in the world for leaf peeping. And there are certain areas of the United States that are better for this. It's highly organized tourist activity in New England and in Colorado. It's okay in southern New Jersey, a little bit. It's certainly not like Vermont or Massachusetts. And I don't know about the Pacific Northwest because I've only been there during the summer. But it's highly variable. There are good years and bad years. And you could, you know, there are hotlines that you can call to find out if you're bed and breakfast.
Yeah, I know. I was just curious about the why, how to get there, but the why, so that you would sort of know ahead of time. Should I go book a bed and breakfast well ahead of time?
You don't really know until the fall rains, you know, because if you've had a really hot, dry summer and you are getting no triggering fall rains, then chances are you are not going to have a spectacular display. And by then, it's all booked anyway, so.
Oh, yes, but there might be cancellations. The number to call, 1-800-423-8255. Rebecca is on the line. Go ahead, Rebecca.
This is a really good program. I've enjoyed it very much. I teach perennial gardening, and I grow perennials, and I talk perennials. And this program has encapsulated what I feel the more I do this, which is there are as many opinions as there are gardeners. And I think it's wonderful that this is branching out and people are talking about it more. I adore the autumn. It's wonderful. I live north of Boston in Zone 5, and there's still so much to come in my garden. There are things that haven't even thought about blooming yet. The Japanese anemones, the aster, Alma Pochke. I have one aster, Oblongifolis, I don't know if you're familiar with it, that blooms until Thanksgiving. It just will not stop. It's out there blooming in the snow a lot of times. Two rules in my garden. One is the plant has to like where it is, and the other is that I have to like the plant. And those are the only two rules. Everything else is up for grabs. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Rebecca.
You know, I came across, I've got this gorgeous book in front of me. It's called Designing with Plants, by Piet Udolf, who is a very well-known plantsman in Allen's and my circle and has introduced a lot of really fabulous perennials into mainstream American horticulture. And one of the reasons I love this book and recommend this book for anybody who is afraid of autumn is that this is when this guy really, his photographs and his plants really come together and really sing. I mean, you know, it's the jumble, it's the chaos, it's the seed heads, it's the things that haven't even thought about flowering that start to pop up. And he's got this great line in here. She was talking about rules, and he says that, you know, plants can be beautiful in death as well as in life. Some might argue that a plant is not worth growing unless it looks good when it is dead.
But dead late, I think, not dead early.
Dead late. Good point.
Can I jump in here just a second? For this, something that has not come up that I think is really important in American gardening, and it has a lot to do with the autumn, and that is we are seeing a lot more use of tropical and subtropical plants as annuals, or as plants that are held over in the winter. The it's 10 years ago. If you'd said coleus to me, I would have said, "God, you know, a coleus?
What is a coleus?"
A coleus is a flame nettle, they call it. It's a plant that roots easily. It's got very colorful leaves. It's a little bit on the gaudy side. But now what's happened, and all of a sudden your very sophisticated gardeners are saying, you have to see my, you know, I got 50 new coleus this year. And these are cultivated varieties that are treasured and that are propagated from one year to the next. And they have names like Pineapple Queen and Burgundy Giant and Rex Celestis, I suppose, Rob Roy. They produce enormous amounts of color apart from the flowers. They get bigger and bigger and bigger from June on until October, when they're finally cut down by frost.
The trend towards tropicals is also transforming the look of our fall gardens?
I believe. And the Brugmansias, Katzel, I wish you could see my angel trumpets.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Oh, no, that's... Yes.
Quite literally.
Well, I didn't mean it in any way that other than the completely above board.
Yes. Who would have thunk a program on an autumn garden could be so risque?
Well, I tell you, flowers are erotic, and our life depends on them. And they were around here before we were. And they worked out their transactions with each other. We did not as human beings invent sex. Plants were much more clever than we were. You know, they've gotten other beings to do it for them.
Ketzel, are you a big fan of these tropical plants or not?
I'm a fan of some of them. I mean, I don't like it as a gimmick. Because there are a lot of tropical plants that are now, you know, just a fad like everything else, and they'll go away. You know, we're awfully big on bananas out here, which are fabulous for foliage, and they do get cut back to the ground in winter, but come back, they do not fruit. And we've got stuff like that, which I think is very exciting. We've got a lot of hardy palms that are very exciting.
Of course, I should caution our listeners that Ketzel is, I think it's fair to say, a bigger fan of foliage than she is of flowers. This has been a major dispute in our relationship.
But we've survived it.
Yeah. So on this one, Alan, I might be with you. I don't know. I don't know what these things look like, but I'm going to go find out.
Well, I can provide you with tropical flowers too. Mandevillas, plumbagos, and the salvias. Again, you know, these are things that. And I really want to push the salvias because most people don't know what they're really like. And, you know, there's ones that are velvety. There's a Mexican bush salvia with purple flowers, velvety, and you can pull the little individual blossoms off, and just like children do with honeysuckle, you can, you know, suck it and get a little drop of nectar.
The number is 1-800-423-8255, and Barbara is calling from Bridgewater, Massachusetts. Go ahead, Barbara.
Well, I wanted to sing the praises of the sedum, but before I did that, the other day you had a program on strange things in science.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to say is, why is it that I look like a pig who has rolled in my compost when I do my gardening, and everyone else looks, even the British, when they picture women in the garden, they have white gloves on. And I thought, my God, what am I doing wrong?
Okay, Ketzel, do you look like a pig or a Brit?
I look like a pig. When I garden, you know, I walk out into the garden and I instantly just turn to mud. I cannot garden nicely.
Oh, I'm so pleased to hear that. I'll go on to my sedum. I want to sing the praises of sedum. I bought one plant many years ago, and at the end, in the fall, I took my knife and I cut it in half, and then I put it to the other side. Actually, I had it at a cemetery. And since then, I think I lost count after 48, but I have divided it and made at least 48 plants. And every time I meet someone to whom I've given them, I often forget. But then they remind me and tell me about the fact that they have divided the plant and it has gone. It's beautiful.
What does it look like? I don't know what a sedum looks like.
It blooms in October. The most popular one is Autumn Joy, and it is it has a thick green leaf. It's very sturdy. You almost can't kill it, and it's just perfect for the fall.
No flowers, though, huh?
Yes, it blooms.
Oh, yes, flowers.
It blooms.
What color flowers?
It has, autumn gold. It's this rustic, reddish, a deep, It's almost maroon, and the flowers are many, many tiny flowers. And when they turn, you don't have to cut them because then they turn brown, and you can use them for dried flowers and spray them. I bring them in and spray them pink and purple and all different colors and use them as dried flowers.
Hmm. You like them, Quetzal?
Sure.
You like them, Alan?
Yeah, Autumn Joy is, I like one called Brilliant a little bit better, and Autumn Joy, it kind of flops.
Okay,
but
it flops.
It also, I say, you know, the buds look, it produces the effect of flowering in the garden over a longer period because the buds, which appear in late July, are really wonderful. They look like broccoli.
So Quetzal, I know that you have something that you wanted to read to us about autumn as we begin to think about ending our program on autumn, and we can only begin to think about ending it. Have you got it in front of you?
Yeah, I do. It's a passage from a book called Some Branch Against the Sky, written by Geoffrey Dutton, who is a Scottish, believe it or not, he's a molecular biologist. He's also a climber and a poet and a very accomplished garden writer. And he gardens in the Scottish Highlands, and I wanted to read to you a beautiful section about the autumn in his garden. Autumn can be our brightest season, everywhere from deep in the gorge up to morning frosted slopes of turf and heather, and everything, stem, leaf, berry, bud, wakens to a carnival of color, yellow, orange, reds, and purples, splendid under long-shadowed sunlight and the blue skies of violet clouds of September and early October. Now you realize the insufficiency of green, its muffling of color as well as of form. Flowers become superfluous, not just to a restful garden, but to a brilliant one. I rest my case.
Yeah, Quetzal Levine, the doyen of dirt, gets the last word on this. Alan Lacy, gardener extraordinaire, writer about gardens extraordinaire, thank you. This is my last day hosting The Connection. After doing it for 2 weeks now and a couple of weeks earlier in May, and I want to say thank you first to the listeners for tuning in and being so smart. And I want to say thank you also to the staff that makes this station such an asset to the community. You hear me on the air, you don't hear them, but they're the people who make me sound so smart myself most of the time, maybe not all of the time. And these are the names that I race through every day, but these are the names of the people who really make The Connection what it is. Kim Bashari, Darren Mnuchin, Tim Monroe, Graham Smith, the producer, Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Stefan Katsonis, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, Karen Schiffman, and Doug Sugarts, our senior producer, Tara Murphy. And you can continue our conversation by going to the website, theconnection.org. I'm Nina Totenberg. This is NPR.
This is W.